funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
And I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire. Coming up, the race for the White House in the Granite State. Candidates working against the clock to win over undecided voters.
And polls. There are dozens in New Hampshire and lots of reasons not to trust them, too. From voters who change their minds or who can only be reached on cell phones to people who just aren't home.
My experience when I was polling in 96 and 2000 was that the number of answering machines that we were encountering was so high that we were not able to get callbacks and so forth.
These stories and an Hispanic artist of the spoken word coming up Here and Now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. On the eve of the New Hampshire primary, Democratic presidential candidates are stepping up their effort to sway the undecided voters who could decide the hard-fought contest. NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
Polls show John Kerry has a sizable lead in New Hampshire, but the Massachusetts senator is taking nothing for granted in this final day of campaigning before the primary. Kerry is scheduled to appear in half a dozen places around the state, traveling by bus and helicopter. His campaign day won't end until nearly 11 o'clock this evening. Former New Hampshire Governor Gene Shaheen is also traveling on Kerry's behalf, along with singer-songwriter Carole King. Retired General Wesley Clark is scheduled to visit every county in New Hampshire, and other candidates are also crisscrossing the state, hoping to win a few more supporters in these final hours. The first New Hampshire voters go to the polls just after midnight. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Manchester, New Hampshire.
A massive matrix of winter storms has dumped snow, sleet, and freezing rain across more than half of the nation, from the Plain States to the East Coast. Schools, businesses, and government offices are closed in several states today, including North Carolina, which got a treacherous glaze of ice. Julia Hegley is with the state's Department of Transportation.
In North Carolina, we not only get snow, but a lot of times we get a lot of ice, and that is what makes the driving so bad. It's one thing when you drive in snow. It's another thing when you have to drive in ice. You really have no control.
North Carolina's governor has declared a state of emergency there. A delegation of congressmen has visited a nuclear reactor site in Libya today. Libya has pledged to dismantle its nuclear weapons development program and wants the United States to lift economic sanctions. Lawmakers in Connecticut are voting today on whether to create a committee to investigate Governor John Rowland. He has admitted accepting gifts from politically connected state contractors. John Dankosky of member station WNPR reports.
State lawmakers are gathering at the Capitol in Hartford for a special session to approve a committee of inquiry, which could recommend impeaching Governor Rowland. The 10-member team, made up of five Republicans and five Democrats, will have to set ground rules for the investigation. Connecticut's state constitution is vague about impeachment, and the only case they can draw from is that of a probate judge in the early 1980s. Some lawmakers have expressed concern about the legislative investigation getting in the way of an ongoing federal probe into bid rigging within the Rowland administration. Rowland, a three-term Republican, has paid ethics fines in the past for accepting gifts and has said he lied about work done to his vacation home. Many key state politicians and newspapers have called for his resignation. Rowland says he plans to serve the rest of his term in office. For NPR News, I'm John Dankosky in Hartford.
The Congressional Budget Office is forecasting a slight improvement in this year's record federal budget deficit, but the CBO's budget outlook foresees new evidence of worsening deficits over the next decade. This is NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, Toyota is now second only to General Motors in vehicle sales. The Japanese firm has pulled ahead of Ford in sales figures, as Craig Folly of member station WDET reports.
Sales figures released by Toyota showed the company sold 6.78 million vehicles in the global market, a nearly 10% improvement over last year. That was enough to leapfrog Ford Motor Company, which saw sales decline 3% to 6.72 million units. Toyota has been riding a wave of high-quality rankings and high customer loyalty. It offers as many sport utility vehicles as any brand, yet it avoids much of the backlash over the environmental aspects of SUVs because of the popularity of its Prius, a hybrid gas-electric vehicle. Toyota officials are downplaying the significance of the company's passing of Ford. Toyota President Fujio Cho said, quote, "We still have so much more to learn." General Motors is still number one in sales with over 8.5 million vehicles sold last year. For NPR News, I'm Craig Folly in Detroit.
Sales of previously owned homes jumped nearly 7% in December. David Luray is chief economist with the National Association of Realtors.
Primarily, it's being fueled by historic low interest rates. No one thought that mortgage rates would just stay this low. They've actually gone down over the past 2 months. So it really is fueling the boom in housing, and the boom continues. All the fundamentals look very, very strong right now.
Luray says for the year, home sales were up nearly 10%, breaking the sales record set just a year earlier. Wall Street at this hour, the Dow is up 26 points at 10,594 in moderate trading, but the Nasdaq is down 4 at 2119. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the N.E.E. Casey Foundation, supporting families and neighborhoods by funding initiatives aimed at helping disadvantaged children, on the web at aecf.org.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire.
It's Here and Now.
Timing is everything. Can John Kerry hold his momentum from the Iowa caucuses just one more day? Will Howard Dean have time to climb back from his self-described "I have a scream" moment in Iowa? Can either of them, along with Joe Lieberman, Wesley Clark, John Edwards, Dennis Kucinich, and Al Sharpton, get New Hampshire voters to change or make up their minds? The primaries are tomorrow, and joining us at the Comfort Inn in Manchester, New Hampshire, is Peter Canellos, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe. And hi, Peter. Nice to see you face to face.
Hi, Robin.
And you were telling me that Senator Kerry would have loved to have had the primary yesterday, while Howard Dean could use one more day.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that right now the dynamic has been Dean supporters, former Dean supporters, turning to Senator Kerry. And yet, after that ABC primetime interview with Dean and his wife, there seems to have been a little bit of a turnaround, and some of those people are now returning to Governor Dean, and certainly the Dean campaign hopes to keep that momentum going.
Right. One poll shows Kerry and Dean in a statistical tie. Another, Kerry 20 points ahead. Yet another, the USA Today Gannett poll shows Dean behind by 11 points. We'll have more on the nature of polling and why it's so wildly over the place. But are you surprised that it is so wildly all over the place?
The polling, I'm not surprised, is so far all over the place. And there's also another factor in the New Hampshire primary, which is this odd situation with a large number of independent voters. And every time they have a primary, you know, the independents will vote, whether it's a Republican side or the Democratic side. But it's never clear how many of them will come out. And it depends on whether there's a candidate that engages them. So if there is somebody who's really excited the independent voters, there'll be a huge unexpected turnout on Election Day that can really turn things around. That's what happened with John McCain 4 years ago.
Right. In fact, we're going to speak to some independent voters later in the program, but it does feel more intense in New Hampshire this year, doesn't it, or is it just the cold?
I think it's intense because the voters are very much keying on the personal qualities of the candidates. You hear a lot of people talking about electability. You hear a lot of people referencing character issues that have been raised in the past. I think some of that is because in some of these previous campaigns we've seen, the Iowa caucuses have been far less of a factor. So the New Hampshire primary is sort of the first, you know, introduction to these candidates that that people have. In some ways, this year, this is the second stop on the trail. And so voters are already processing what they've learned in Iowa about these candidates and are asking more sophisticated questions.
Tell us what you're seeing out there, because, for instance, in one of the polls, the subset of one of the major polls today, it shows that if people were asked who was more in touch with the average American, they said 26 to 23 Dean was. In other words, 26% said Dean, 23 said Kerry. And I'm talking about the two leaders right now. But when asked who could beat Bush, 56% said Senator John Kerry, 16% said Howard Dean. Again, we're going to talk about why these polls are often not trustworthy, but that sense of who's more electable, how are you seeing the candidates respond to that?
Well, obviously, Governor Dean has responded by trying to appear to be as reasonable and mature and statesmanlike a presence as possible. And they think they've come, his campaign thinks that they've come upon sort of the right formula by having him campaign with his wife, who's been sort of surprisingly winning on the stump and who can sort of attest to his personal loyalties and his personal virtues in a way that some of these endorsements really can't. On the other hand, Senator Kerry has a certain stature and has a certain, sort of voice of authority on the stump that he's playing up quite strongly and trying to develop a kind of front runner's air of inevitability about him. And people seem to be responding to that as well.
Mm. Front pages of the paper today, the Concord Monitor, big headline piece, Judy Dean Arrives, Not a Moment Too Soon. She campaigned with her husband over the week, and there was a women's forum in particular. And the head of the Manchester Union Leader, a big picture of Joe Lieberman along with Howard Dean, the paper endorsing Joe Lieberman today. Just with the few seconds that we have left, what do you see happening tomorrow? I hate to do that, but how do you see it unfolding?
Yeah, I don't really make comfortable predictions either. I will say that, you know, we're all focused right now on the Kerry and Dean dynamic. Somebody else will probably get a jolt out of New Hampshire, too. Some of those undecided voters will go to somebody, be it Clark or Lieberman or John Edwards.
Is it also a race for third?
That's the only prediction I'll make, is that there'll be a race for third, and the person who we think of as finishing third could even bump out the person who's we're thinking of finishing second.
Peter, I know you're going to be here tomorrow. Just real quick, there's a chance of a snowstorm. The weather is frigid, but New Hampshireites, the weather's not going to stop them.
Yeah, weather's probably not going to stop them, but to the extent that you can discern some advantage, people feel that the Dean supporters are a little more passionate and, more likely to go out no matter what. Mm.
Peter, thank you.
Thank you.
As usual, Peter Canellos, Washington Bureau Chief of the Boston Globe, speaking to us from here at the Comfort Inn in Manchester, New Hampshire.
Well, for weeks now, polls about what will happen in New Hampshire have blared from headlines and newscasts, rising like a gathering tide that can drown out, some say, deeper analysis of issues. And yet, in New Hampshire, the polls have almost always proven either off or dead wrong. Why is that? We're joined now by Linda Fowler, the director of the Rockefeller Center for Social Science at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Welcome, Linda.
Hi, Bill.
Linda, about a dozen polls being conducted in New Hampshire at this point. How do they arrive at their numbers?
Well, the key factor in any of these surveys is identifying likely voters. And most pollsters use a question which basically asks people, how likely are you to vote? And the respondent says, definitely, probably, probably not, definitely not, or some variation on that question. And the problem always is whether the people who say they probably will or probably will not get counted as likely voters. But, in fact, we have no way of knowing whether, in fact, they're going to show up that day.
They're phoning people, right, Linda?
That's correct. And, of course, not everybody has a regular phone anymore, particularly young people have cell phones. My experience when I was polling in 96 and 2000 was that the number of answering machines that we were encountering by 2000 was so high that we were not able to get callbacks and so forth.
And how many of these phone calls are made during the day?
Well, pollsters try to phone in the evening and usually at the beginning of the week in order to catch people when they're home. But there are some kinds of people who are less likely to be home in the evening than others. In other words, it's not necessarily a representative cross-sample. So some pollsters will do callbacks during the day, but callbacks cost money, and I think there's a lot of variation in terms of how persistent these pollsters are in really tracking down the people.
So, Linda, does the information gathered have any value?
The problem is that when you're trying to predict an outcome, not just measure what people's attitudes are, that's where polling gets less reliable. It's a good snapshot on any given day of what people are thinking that day. But people are not consistent in what they think about the candidates during the height of a campaign, which is why we found that a lot of people changed their minds. It wasn't just the undecided voters, the people who were honest and said, you know, I don't know which candidate I'm going to support on election day. There were also people who made a candidate choice, but then who, by the time they actually went to the polls, told us the day after the election they'd voted for somebody different than the person they told us.
And finally, Linda, 38% or so of voters in New Hampshire consider themselves independents.
Mm-hmm.
They can show up and register on primary day and vote for anybody they want.
That's correct. And that was more of a problem in 2000, where they had their choice of voting in the Republican primary, the Democratic primary. But the real issue is whether they're going to turn out. And we just don't know. So I think that the polls are accurate right now in describing people. But the problem is there's an election tomorrow.
How seriously should people who see a poll take it?
Political scientists are uniformly united in condemning the disproportionate amount of attention that the news media pay to polls. This is not useful information for voters. And what many of us say is that the news media are making news. They're the ones that commission the polls. They're the ones that then turn around and report the news that they've just made.
So what's your prediction, Linda? No, just kidding. Just kidding.
My prediction is that it's unpredictable.
Linda Fowler, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Linda Fowler is director of the Rockefeller Center for Social Science at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire. Problems deepened at Halliburton over the weekend. The Houston-based contractor, once headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, announced Friday that two employees at a Kuwait subsidiary had been fired for running a kickback scheme on reconstruction contracts in Iraq. Halliburton has reimbursed the federal government for $6 million of overcharges. This is in addition to earlier charges that Halliburton subsidiaries overbilled for fuel in Iraq. Those accusations allege tens of millions of dollars in overcharges. Several senior Democrats renewed their calls this weekend for a congressional inquiry into the U.S.-funded reconstruction effort in Iraq. The story is being reported by Neil King of The Wall Street Journal. He joins us now. Hello, Neil.
Hello there.
Halliburton came forward on its own with details of this latest overbilling, correct?
It did. It came amidst a lot of inquiry that is focusing at the moment on the contracting office in Kuwait itself, which is the same office that handled the subcontracting work on the gasoline contract that you mentioned.
These two employees, Halliburton seems to admit, took money in return for giving a contract to a certain Kuwaiti firm. Is that how this worked?
That's about the extent of our knowledge on this at the moment. It is a Kuwaiti company. It was within the whole huge contract that Halliburton has for administering and catering to the needs of the U.S. Army in Iraq and all the U.S. officials that are there. And there was some kind of a kickback scheme. We don't precisely know the exact amount that the employees got, but the damage was a little over $6 million. This is the amount that Halliburton stepped forward and reimbursed on Friday.
Now, Neil, as you said, these are huge contracts, billions of dollars floating around. How unusual is it for two rotten apples to be found taking kickbacks?
You know, actually, kickbacks like this are not necessarily all that common, and they are, of course, a huge matter within the government when they are found. I think there is some concern just because of the huge amounts of money that have poured into the Iraq effort, the vast majority of which has gone through the Kellogg Brown and Root subsidiary of Halliburton, that there could be a fair bit more, not necessarily of kickbacks, but just of other kinds of financial shenanigans or just general loose accounting principles, just because it's been difficult for KBR, as it's known, to keep pace with the amount of work that it's being asked to do and the huge amount of money that's flowing into that work. And the Pentagon has been expressing this concern in a variety of documents, some of which I've gotten my hands on, that are basically saying that their financial apparatus just isn't up to par with the amount of work that they're having to do on the ground.
What's the chance that hearings will be convened on this, as Democratic congressmen want?
It's very hard to judge at the moment. I mean, this is, of course, something that is left entirely to the Republicans who control both houses of Congress, and I think that their desire to see this happen is not very high, particularly considering the political season and the proximity of the November election and the fact that this is a very hot subject because it both involves the biggest foreign policy objective underway now, which is the rebuilding of Iraq, and a company formerly run by the vice president. So it's a kind of explosive mix, and I think the Republicans aren't terribly interested in stirring still further. But I think in some ways it'll depend on to what extent still more comes out, and I don't think there necessarily has to be that much more before the pressure is maybe more than they can withstand in some ways.
Neil King, Washington reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Neil, thanks very much.
It's a pleasure.
Just ahead, with bacon and eggs and pancakes on their plates, we ask New Hampshire voters what's on their minds one day before the big day.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's here and now.
The Federal Commission investigating the 9/11 terrorist attacks meets today and tomorrow in Washington. And while the 10-member bipartisan panel continues to probe what went wrong that day, in this session, what went right may also be highlighted. Sean Waterman is Homeland Security correspondent for UPI. He's covering the hearings. Hi, Sean.
Oh, hello.
Sean, key testimony today by Customs Agent Jose Melendez Perez. What story does he have to tell?
Well, he talks about what happened at Orlando Airport on August the 4th, 2001, a few weeks prior to the attacks, when he was on duty as an immigration inspector and basically turned away a guy because he didn't believe his story. The guy had a visa. A Saudi national called Qatami. But Mr. Melendez Perez was not satisfied with the answers to the questions which he asked about Mr. Qatami's ability to support himself in the United States and his plans while he was here, so he turned him away.
So, Sean, there's some rare enough good news about 9/11. Any more along those lines?
We also learned today that two other people, in addition to the two we already knew about, thought to be connected with the plot were refused visas. We already know that the main operational planner, Ramzi bin al-Sheikh, was refused a visa on numerous occasions. We also know that a fellow member of the Hamburg cell, a Moroccan called Essabar, had also been refused a visa. Today we learned that a Pakistani, actually the nephew of the mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, was refused a visa, and a fourth man, a Saudi. So some good news, but also a lot of bad news. We now know that as many as 11 of the hijackers may have had passports which were either which had been tampered with or which contained what the commission is calling other suspicious indicators. They're not giving any details because the details are classified, but essentially up to 11 of the hijackers had passports which should have aroused the suspicion of the people looking at them.
Now, Sean, the commission is supposed to give a final ruling by May 27th, but some on the commission want more time. They say they need more time. The Bush administration is wary of that, reportedly, because they don't want this commission pushing too close to election time. Tell us about these problems with when to issue a final report and where it's headed.
Well, it's a tricky question, and it's one that's maybe in danger of overshadowing the revelations today. There will be a business meeting of the commission. I believe that they may have met yesterday evening. They meet in secret for their business meetings, and they're very cagey about even announcing that they're going on. Certainly, my reporting shows that a large majority of members of the commission do believe that an extension would be a good thing. Everyone says that if necessary, the commission could finish by the congressionally mandated deadline of May 27th, but that would probably mean scaling back the number and the length of public hearings, and that is something that the families of the victims are very unhappy about. At the moment, it seems that the compromise solution would be to delay the deadline, delay the publication of the commission's report until after the election, until December, which would give them all the time they need and would also take it out of the political battlefield.
Sean Waterman is Homeland Security correspondent for United Press International. He joined us from Washington. Sean, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Well, back in Manchester, New Hampshire, the talk, of course, is of tomorrow's primary. The poor residents here are now outnumbered by media and campaign workers. A variety of polls show that between 4 and 18% of voters are still undecided. And our unscientific poll this morning at the Cityside Diner in Concord reflected that.
I'm confused right now. I was supporting Dean, but I'm one of those people that wants to beat Bush at any cost, so...
Here, here.
it's tough.
I think John Kerry could win. He's very presentable, and we have a very unpresentable president right now, so I think that would help a lot.
I'm voting for George Bush. If I could wave a magic wand and pick the Democrat candidate of choice, I would pick Howard Dean. I would love to run against Howard Dean.
Because
I think it would be a landslide.
For Bush.
But now I'm afraid that he's not going to pull it off, and I think Kerry might do it, yeah. And that's troublesome to me.
It's a tough call. What are you today? We just had Governor Dean on.
Do you mind if I ask you, I know that you are probably taking a break from your work, but
okay.
I can grab you for 2 seconds. Have you been following all this primary action?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Your thoughts?
I don't know. I've always been a George Bush fan, so.
What's that?
I like Howard Dean's attitude and his, just, he talks from his gut and tells you how it is and doesn't care if he ruffles any feathers. Yeah, and I like that.
Would you say?
That's us.
but she is a Bush fan.
Yeah.
Are you as well?
No.
So you like Dean?
Yes, I'm tending to go towards Dean right now.
And not a moment too soon. You're back to the tables.
Absolutely.
And the egg cooked all the way.
Ralph Aldridge, I'm from Berkeley, California.
Claudia Aldridge from Berkeley.
What are you doing here in a diner in Concord, New Hampshire?
Well, we're getting ready to go out and canvass for Howard Dean. We're here to help in every way we can.
Do you pay for your way? Do you pay for your rooms? How does that work?
We pay for our expenses. We're strictly volunteers.
I'm undecided at this point. I'm one of those numerous undecided people that I'm probably not going to make up my mind until sometime later today, or possibly not until I actually walk into the booth tomorrow.
What are you looking for?
I'm looking for a candidate that has, I guess, what you call fire. I don't see too much of that right now.
Well, Howard Dean, you didn't see fire?
Well, I'm not leaning towards Dean. I just don't. I question the gentleman's electability. Strongly considering Kerry and Clark, probably torn between the two of them.
How about you, sir?
I'm a Republican.
So you're probably enjoying this whole thing.
Yes, I am.
And yet, at just about every booth we've been to, there's been a mix of Republicans and Democrats, so you still break bread together.
Oh, yes.
Absolutely. No question about it.
Well, thank you very much. Good luck with your decision. So, fire. You're looking for fire.
That's it. Yeah.
Thoughts we gathered with our breakfast this morning in Concord, New Hampshire. Tomorrow on Here and Now, our coverage from New Hampshire continues. We'll talk with columnist David Broder about covering the New Hampshire primary without his beloved colleague, Mary McGorry, who is 85 and ill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in New Hampshire.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, electability, how much it matters in the race for president.
Most of the voters I talked to were more worried about electability than do I like the person. And I frankly think that voters do themselves a disservice when they go that double step.
And we talked to Latin music critic Jose Maso about the work of David Gonzalez.
He doesn't have the voice of the preacher. He doesn't have that hip-hop cadence to his speaking. But what he does very well, and I find enjoyable, is he really tells a good story.
And these stories coming up. Here and Now.
I'm Dolores Handy. In the final day of campaigning before the New Hampshire primary, Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean is going on the offensive. He and the winner of the Iowa caucuses, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, are swapping criticism of foreign policy credentials. The former Vermont governor is questioning Kerry's judgment in voting against the 1991 Gulf War while supporting the resolution to invade Iraq last year. Kerry, who is still leading in most polls in New Hampshire, has said his views are consistent. North Carolina Senator John Edwards, who finished second in last week's Iowa caucuses and promised to wage a positive campaign, says Kerry has not been clear on the war. Retired General Wesley Clark was taking his campaign bus into all 10 counties in New Hampshire today. Three U.S. soldiers are still missing in Iraq after a boat capsized and a helicopter crashed. The copter with two crew members went down in the Tigris River while searching for a soldier missing from the boat. Afghan President Hamid Karzai signed Afghanistan's new constitution into law in Kabul today. The brief ceremony marked the latest step in a United Nations-sponsored peace drive designed to rebuild Afghanistan following the U.S.-led ousting of the Taliban 2 years ago. The constitution outlines a tolerant, democratic Islamic state with a strong presidency, a two-chamber parliament, and an independent judiciary. The nation's highest court says it will revisit the issue of whether execution of teenagers is a violation of the Constitution's ban on cruel and unusual punishment. The Supreme Court of the United States, which 2 years ago abolished executions for the mentally retarded, announced today that it will now consider ending the execution of killers who were younger than 18 when they committed their crimes. A court hearing this afternoon in Florida could clear the way for 16-year-old Lionel Tate to be released from prison. He's been serving a life sentence for killing a 6-year-old girl. Tate was 12 at the time and says the two were playing. An appeals court threw out his earlier first-degree murder conviction. Following today's bond hearing, Tate is to appear in court again Thursday, where he's expected to accept a plea bargain from prosecutors in which he's to plead guilty to second-degree murder. In return, he'll get credit for the 3 years he served behind bars, a year of house arrest, 10 years probation, and community service. He'll also be ordered to undergo counseling. This is Here and Now.
I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire.
And it's Here and Now.
Well, a couple of weeks ago, it was Howard Dean who made the cover of Newsday for a second time. Today's edition features the newest man of the moment, John Kerry. And today's Newsweek poll, for the first time, shows the Massachusetts senator with a slight lead over President George Bush if the election were held today. But all of the Democrats polled well against President Bush, which might explain why we've seen busloads of campaigners for Bush crisscrossing New Hampshire today, even though only Democrats and independents vote in the primary tomorrow. Our D.C. Roundtable is here to talk election strategy and that elusive electability. Sarah Fritz is Washington Bureau Chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Robin.
And David Shribman, Executive Editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette in Pittsburgh. Hi, David.
Hi, Robin.
And Sarah, to you in Washington first, what steps is the Bush campaign taking to counteract the headlines the Democrats are getting? You know, they're getting all the press. And do you see the Republican strategy changing in the last week?
Well, first of all, they are sending, as you noted, they're sending a lot of people to first Iowa and now New Hampshire in an effort to just keep the president's name in everybody's mind. But the State of the Union reflected a new campaign strategy in many ways. The president has said for years that he didn't respond to polls, and yet you can read that State of the Union speech and see it, that it's the most poll-driven speech I've ever read.
Well, and David, I want to just pick up there. It would be hard, I would think, for the president not to be reacting to this current poll. It shows that 52% of people that Newsweek polled said they wouldn't like to see Bush serve a second term. 49% of registered voters chose Kerry compared to 46% for Bush. And all of the Democrats polled within 5 points of the president. Is that common for this time of year in a campaign year? I mean, again, the Democrats are getting all the press coverage, or something else happening here?
Well, it's not common. It has to be surprising, and it has to be alarming to the president, to Karl Rove, and to all the folks around him. I think they're surprised. I know I am, and it's a dangerous signal. You know, whenever you get over 50% of anything in a poll, you reach a dangerous zone, and the president's in a dangerous zone there.
Yeah, and Sarah, as you said, he's mobilizing the troops. New York's Republican Governor George Pataki and former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani campaigned for the president here over the weekend. Today, Arizona Senator John McCain is headed here. Tomorrow, the Republican National Committee Chair and Massachusetts Governor Mitt Romney. So it's getting crowded up here.
Right. The other thing that the president is doing is trying to sort of fill in places where he appears to be weak. In the State of the Union, he announced two programs, one a jobs program, and the other was some tax credits for health care, because the polls show that he is those are two very weak, vulnerable spots for him.
That's a good point, Sarah. If I could jump in here for a second, Robin, I want to point out, though, that the these surrogates are involved not in selfless enterprise here. If you were to name, say, the four Republicans who are most likely to run for president in 2008, three of them were on your list: Rudy Giuliani, the governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, and George Pataki. So this isn't exactly enlightened self-interest here.
Right. Well, in fact, I was in New Hampshire last week, and some people told me they'd already been contacted by Giuliani about 2008.
Yeah, and so we're seeing two campaigns going on, and we're also seeing, in addition to campaigning for Bush, they're campaigning against, of course, the Democratic candidates. We saw a major offensive from the Republican Party leader this weekend, who said that Kerry was the more liberal senator from Massachusetts, more liberal than Ted Kennedy. And the Republicans seem eager to paint Kerry, right now the leader, as the uber-liberal, you know, who was Lieutenant Governor to Michael Dukakis in Massachusetts. But David, is that going to resonate with younger voters who don't even remember that time period?
Well, a lot of young voters, of course, don't remember who Michael Dukakis was, and they surely don't remember much about Ted Kennedy's presidential campaign of 1980. But Senator Kennedy, as you know, is the kind of the poster boy of liberalism. I think that particularly, I mean, New Hampshire's a very good example because the population has changed so dramatically in the past decade that I'm not sure that pointing to Michael Dukakis isn't a bit like talking about the Brooklyn Dodgers.
And what about the electability discussion among the candidates themselves? One poll shows Dean and Kerry in a statistical tie. Lieberman and Edwards both are claiming momentum today. Clark's struggling, but he still has a Democratic, you know, machinery behind him. Now, a general hasn't been elected in 52 years, a senator in 44 years. How much do their roles matter? going into this?
The interesting thing about electability is that it's almost impossible to judge electability a year out. Electability has a lot of things to do with character and program, but it also has to do with events and how those events in the next year mesh into who is chosen. But it is strange, having been in New Hampshire recently, I note that most of the voters I talked to were more worried about electability than do I like the person.
Mm-hmm.
And I frankly think voters do themselves a disservice when they go that double step.
If you remember, Sarah, that was precisely the Democratic notion when the Democrats nominated 1988 Governor Dukakis, because he wasn't the most this or the most that, but he was the most electable. We think of Governor Dukakis now, in retrospect, as a big-time liberal, but in fact, Governor Dukakis had worked the Massachusetts miracle. He had been involved in public-private partnerships. He was a business-oriented Democrat at the time. The Republicans transformed his image, but they dominated him, the Democrats did, because they thought he was more electable than the others.
Right.
Well, David, isn't that what, you know, what I was talking about is, you know, it seems as if it's been governors and vice presidents, people who have actually run something.
Well, certainly the electorate feels that way. As you know, in the 20th century, only two senators were elected to the presidency. One of them, of course, was President Kennedy, and the second was your all-time favorite, Robin, President Harding.
I would say that trend is going to be hard for John Kerry to buck, because John Kerry really is a senator. He's been in the Congress for 19 years, and I would predict that as the primary season continues, Edwards, who has less experience in Congress, will begin to look better to Democratic voters simply because he is a man who accomplished something, which was that he was a successful trial lawyer.
Sarah, any other factor we should be considering as we consider what the voters are considering?
I think there's a potential bombshell in the weapons of mass destruction issue. Today on the front page of the New York Times is an interview with David Kaye, the weapons inspector, who says that Saddam Hussein did not have a sophisticated program of nuclear and biological weapons. This is going to be a real big issue in the general election, and it will be interesting to watch how the Democrats and the White House respond to this report.
Well, I want to thank you both.
Thank you, and stay warm.
Thank you.
David Shribman, executive editor of the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Sarah Fritz, Washington bureau chief for the St. Petersburg Times of Florida.
Still to come, David Gonzalez, set to music, he speaks his hymns to New York City. There's even an ode to the Cross Bronx Expressway.
You're listening to Here and Now.
If you've seen the film Lost in Translation, you're familiar with private karaoke booths, small rooms for just up to 20 people, where you can belt out your favorite melodies, whether you can hold a tune or not, for some of your most loyal fans, your good friends. Not strangers more likely to, you know, throw tomatoes or something. But in San Mateo, California, the city council has banned these private booths, claiming they've become dens of iniquity with their locked doors and lack of surveillance, where prostitution, drug use, and gambling flourish. Karaoke enthusiasts are crying foul. Well, joining us on the line now from San Mateo, California, is Stephen Lin. He owns the Fuchsia Lounge, where he was about to open up four new private karaoke rooms in his club before the ban went into effect. Welcome, Stephen.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. How do you feel about this ban?
Well, I feel terrible because I feel I've been unreasonably pushed out of the permit application due to this emergency 45-day ordinance. I've been a law-abiding business person for the past 12 years. I can't understand why all the difficulties.
Well, you know, apparently several countries in Asia have targeted karaoke rooms. Vietnam and Hong Kong officials have linked them to these kinds of problems. What do you think about that, Stephen? I mean, if the problem is over in Asia, why not here?
obviously, I think there are plenty out there that are fully legit, and they're perfectly safe and family-oriented for people to go to.
Mm-hmm.
There's bad places everywhere, and I don't think we should single a few out just to say that everything is bad.
Do you have any kind of compromise in your mind, possibly a private karaoke room, you know, where there might be cameras or there might be locks? How would you feel about that?
Well, that is something that I've been working very diligently with the police department. I have brought up numerous attempts in making them safer, and it just doesn't seem like they want to work with me. They've been shutting me out.
From what you know about these private booths, Stephen, what kind of people are attracted to them?
I think there are people of all ages. They're people like us.
I suppose people that are attracted to these private booths are the shyer karaoke lovers among us, right?
Most definitely. You know, some people are not used to the big open lounge style karaoke, and there are major differences between the two.
Stephen, what do you think is going to happen now? There is a 45-day ban until they decide whether to grant your permits or not. What are you predicting here, and what do you think is going to happen?
Well, I think the police chief has made it clear that she's pushing for a permanent ban, and when I first got started with this whole project, I was never told of any such ban that would be in place. And now that I've invested so much money and so much of my time for this last year and a half, and I'm presumed guilty without any kind of due process.
How much money did you spend at the Fusion Lounge to create these four new private rooms?
Well, over $750,000 already. Because of loss in revenue, I had to sell my house in San Mateo just last month, just to keep the business financed. If I don't get it, I fear my business might go down.
Stephen Lin is the owner of the Fusion Lounge in San Mateo, California. Stephen, thanks so much.
Thank you, Bill.
And by the way, here are some sounds of Bill Murray cutting loose in a Japanese karaoke booth in the movie Lost in Translation.
I could feel at the time there was no way of knowing fallen in the night, who can say where they're blowing, as free as the wind, hopefully learning.
Stay with us, there's more ahead, here and now. I'm Bill Delaney in Boston.
I'm Robin Young in Manchester, New Hampshire. It's Here and Now.
David Gonzalez is a poet, spoken word artist, guitarist, playwright, and collective theater director. His latest CD, City of Dreams, with the Poetic License Band featuring Bobby Sanabria, has been hailed as an affectionate, temperamental celebration of New Yorican life in all its tenacious grit and glory, an earnest, upbeat, unapologetic portrait of Gotham. In the title track, Gonzalez describes the city of opportunity, the city of dreams, New York City.
This New York, this asobao, minestrone, wonton, gumbo stew. This one right here, right now. The New York beneath our feet. The New York beside us in the turban, in the dashiki, pierced, buttoned down, opened up New York. Hidden as the crucifix tucked into the bright orange FUBU jersey.
Here and Now's Latin music lover Jose Masso joins me in the studio to discuss David Gonzalez and the Poetic License Band featuring Bobby Sanabria and their new CD, City of Dreams. Hi, Jose.
Hello, Bill.
Jose, David Gonzalez was born in the Bronx. He got a PhD in music therapy from New York University. He then became a social worker. How did he get to the point where he's recorded this spoken word tribute to New York City?
After having spent so many years working as a social worker in the school systems and the mental health field, he, I think, finally decided that his real calling was poetry and storytelling and the spoken word. And, you know, I was inspired to bring this particular CD to our attention because last week, everywhere, when you turn on the radio, you would hear the great voice of Martin Luther King. And I thought, you know, so many years later, and this man's voice still resonates, the power of the voice, the power of his speeches, of his words during interviews. Who is doing this kind of work now in this kind of genre of the spoken word? And I thought, you know, we've had some great people, the hip poets, you know, Jack Kerouac, Allen Ginsberg, my favorite, Felipe Luciano and the Last Poets, Gil Scott Heron, who is sort of like the prelude to hip-hop mm-hmm. and whatnot. But I thought, who's doing this? And I came across David Gonzalez's CD with the Poetic License Band. And I said, now here's something we have to listen to. He doesn't have the voice of the preacher. He doesn't have that hip-hop cadence to his speaking. But what he does very well, and I find enjoyable, is he really tells a good story. He really tells a good story. And what I'd like to hear now is something about his family roots. This goes to the fact that he is the son of a Cuban father and a Puerto Rican mother. And this selection is titled The Secret of the Ceiba Tree. It's a reflection on his family's connections with the islands, and it features someone that you've heard before, Yomo Toro, on the cuatro guitar from Puerto Rico.
In Quebradillas, Puerto Rico, there are a pair of thick ceiba trees which live on the narrow grass divider between the eastbound and westbound arteries of Ruta Dos. Their canopy shades the comings and goings of San Juaneros, campesinos, retirees, locos, turistas, and second-generation New Yorkans like me, who hunger for a bit of the island's dirt and a taste of our own history.
That is so musical, and yet nobody's singing. It is rare enough to hear that sort of thing.
It is, and that's what I was saying. He doesn't have what you would expect in spoken word as far as that poetic, you know, beat and whatnot, but it blends in well. And I think he has a musical ear to his voice, if I can use that expression, in the sense that he's found his musical instrument and it is his voice.
Yeah, there's a real fluidity there.
Yes.
There's certainly no gimmick to it.
No, not at all. Not at all.
Who is Bobby Sanabria?
Bobby Sanabria is a Puerto Rican musician out of New York City, graduated from Berklee College of Music for a time. He was teaching here, also teaches at the New School in New York, Grammy Award nominated percussionist, who has played with some of the great bands, including the great Machito, and plays with Larry Harlow and the Latin Legends. And that's how he and David hooked up. And this is a perfect pairing for David because he was able to bring someone who has a deep understanding of both Latin music, jazz, and music in general, and it has that real New York feel. And I think that this coupling of David through his stories and poems and Bobby through his arrangements and musical depth makes this album work.
Now, this is such a New York City album that he's actually got a cut on the thing called The Cross Bronx Expressway. How do you make poetry out of that?
Well, I think what he does is that he tells us through the music as well that what experience it is to drive on the Cross Bronx Expressway. And the energy in this particular selection speaks to that experience. Bobby Sanabria has made a great arrangement for this particular selection off City of Dreams, and it's titled simply that, The Cross Bronx Expressway.
The blackened canyons of the Cross Bronx Expressway, solid still after Europe, Korea, Da Nang, and the assassinations of the 60s. Solid still after trickle down to a dry choke economics, after Watergate and Contragate, after Lindsey, Veeam, Cox, Dinkins, and Giuliani, after Grenada, Somalia, Desert Storm, and Bosnia. Still the blackened canyon walls of the Cross Bronx hold back the crush of Jerome Avenue, Webster Avenue, and the Grand Concourse.
Capturing the Cross Bronx Expressway, of course, that's assuming it's a day when the thing's actually moving.
True. It's that, unless you want to take another route. But that is the energy of New York.
And pulsing bass.
Yes. And again, you know, he must have been thinking about this CD for some time. And at the moment that Bobby and he sat down and spoke about what is it we want to do, my sense is that first David came with what the words were and what the themes were. And then Bobby came through and said, okay, I think this is the music that will go for it. And so in many ways, when they say featuring Bobby Sanabria, it is a McCartney-Lennon type of combination here. One may be taking the title in the sense of it's David Gonzalez's project, but Bobby's right there making this thing happen.
Latin sounds, of course, on this. But if you're talking about New York City and you're talking about music, you're also talking about jazz, right?
Yes, and I think, you know, David, as all of us who've ever experienced New York City, understands that you cannot speak about the city without paying tribute to those great musicians who have come before them that particularly had a role with Latin or jazz. And in this case, jazz being the great Duke Ellington, jazz being Take the A-Train. And this story is very interesting. He titles it Yankee Landia, and he combines the experience of New York, Yankee Landia. I mean, think about that. Yankee Landia, New York Yankees, the Yankees meaning United States. And then he combines Cuba and what was happening in Cuba and thinking about the big bands from the United States. And he does it again, sampling the music of Duke Ellington, Take the A-Train. This one he titles Yankee Landia.
In Santiago de Cuba, 1941, the golden days of the light-skinned Cuban elite before they lost everything to Fidel and the mixed blessings of the revolution. My father Manolo, his cousin René, and the boys from the Club Atlético tuned their radios to the Voice of America to hear her stomping at the Savoy, to snap their fingers and bop their heads to Artie Shaw, Cab Calloway, the Dorseys, and Gene Krupa!
Not a poet who's expressing a lot of anger. It's a real celebration, even to the point of a gospel-inflected cut, which we might finish up with.
Yes, this features his wife, Lisa Sokoloff, who's an excellent singer. And when you hear this one, and I was intrigued as to why he would wind up this recording of New York City with this CD, but the words speak to the fact that, you know, in many ways, the gathering waters and the fact that every you know, stream and river winds up going someplace, and in this place that it's going to is New York City. And it's a beautiful rendition with a very gospel tinge sung by his wife, Lisa Sokoloff, titled Gathering Waters.
Let there be a song of praise for the gathering waters at this place. Let there be a song of praise for the nameless tributaries, and a song for the seven seas.
Let there be a song, sing a song.
City of Dreams is the album. The spoken word artist is David Gonzalez, joined by some wonderful musicians, and as we just heard, his own wife on that cut, Gathering Waters. Jose Maso, thanks a lot for bringing this to us.
Bill, my pleasure.
Here and Now's Latin music lover, Jose Maso, is the host of Con Salsa on WBUR in Boston.
Let there be a song of praise for bracing Canadian springs, for the Yangtze and the Mississippi Delta, for Hudson Bay and Harlem River.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young, reporting from New Hampshire.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
To each other, white-capped and tumultuous, making something new in the brackish womb of their joining.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young, reporting from New Hampshire.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
Our coverage from the Granite State continues.
And we look at the wit and wonderful writing of columnist Mary McGrory, who's in her 80s and ill and sorely missed by her colleagues on the campaign trail.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.